Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, I am very grateful that you have joined me for a few minutes today, or maybe more than just a few minutes. Let's be honest, these shows tend to run like an hour long, but however long we discuss the latest set in the big old binder of baseball cards, I'm so glad that you're able to join us here. And we're looking at a dandy of a set, a popular one, one of my favorites, and you could argue it is the best set in terms of design, not necessarily rookie power or star power, although there are some pretty good stars in here and a couple notable rookies. 1976 Topps, you could argue, is the best set of the 70s. Now, I know a lot of people will lean towards the 71 set. Others, for various reasons, may say, oh, well, 72 and 75 have better rookies, even though they're kind of a tacky design. Maybe you're a little more of the conservative type. You prefer the late 70s sets. But 1976 Topps really brings it all together. And our random pull, and this is a rather fortuitous selection from 76 Topps, because our random pull is somebody who is best known for three particular incidents in his career. One of them happened in 1976. Yes, Rick Monday, then with the Cubs, soon to be with the Dodgers, and in fact would be with the Dodgers for the rest of his career, did a remarkable thing in a game in April of 1976 at Dodger Stadium as a member of the Cubs. We will discuss that in a moment. The other two events, by the way, happening in 1965 and 1981. He did have a pretty serviceable career, pretty lengthy career, too, despite some injuries slowing him down later on in his career. But it's three particular events that really stand out in Rick Monday's career, and we'll talk about one of them because it just happens to have happened in 1976 when we pulled, the year that we pulled this card from. So we'll discuss that and the 76 top set after we talk a little bit about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. And pretty quiet this week, although I will say a lot of the discussion is all about our previous podcast, 75 Topps, where there's a lot of love for 75 Topps. A lot of love, despite the fact that I did call it a very tacky set. And you have to be honest with yourself here. You look at the design of 75 Topps, and it is a design that definitely pops out at you. But even though it is a loud set with the colors and the little 3D leap at you effect of the team name, it is something that it's still very popular with collectors, mostly because of the Yount and the Brett rookie cards, but also because it is so colorful. A lot of people who were kids at that time collected that set, remember it well, and still remember it to this day. Now, a few other topics that were discussed this past week on our Twitter feed, and by the way, a quick sidebar here, my sultry radio voice today is brought to you by a minor sinus infection. So you have not tuned into the Susan Plachette Impression Hour here on Wax Ecstatic. Oh, hi, Bob. No, it's just I'm a little nasally today. It'll clear up by next week, I promise. But anyway, some other things that came up during this past week on Wax and Gum Stains. I found, I was on vacation last week, and I was shuffling through a vending box of 89 Topps. I finally decided, if you listen to our podcast on 89 Topps, I said during that show, I said, you know, if there's one set I regret getting rid of all those extra cards that I had in the, about 10 or 12 years ago when I just got rid of about 30,000 cards because I got tired of carrying them around. There's actually two sets that I regret just getting rid of all the extras. One is 91 Bowman. Love 91 Bowman. And that's one of those sets I'm probably going to buy a box of one of these days, a box of wax packs and tear them up and try to assemble the set. But the other set was 89 Topps. So I bought a lot of vending boxes to help complete. I've been on this 15-year-old mission to complete a set of 87, 90, and 91 Topps because I had a lot of those cards hanging around. So I figured, you know what, I've got so many of these cards, I could probably just complete the sets. So I'm getting a little closer to doing that. And as I mentioned in the previous show, doing it, trying to complete a set through vending boxes, it's a shotgun approach, but it's kind of neat to go thumbing through these boxes. So part of the lot was 87, 90, and 91, but you also had 88 and 89. So the 88 vending box just basically just went into a storage box. I'm not sure what I'm going to do with that. But 89 tops. I'm looking through and I'm trying to build a set from it. So I'm going through this vending box and I find a card that really just leapt out at me in terms of what is on the back. And I had to send this to one of our followers, Sports Card Backs. It's card number 607 from 89 Tops. Willie Ansley, who is a prospect, a first-round draft pick for the Houston Astros back in 1988. And this was Topps' method of trying to get ahead of the curve on rookie cards at the time. Basically, they would take, I would say, the top five or six picks, maybe a little more than that. It might have been eight. But, you know, the top picks of the previous summer's draft. And they would create a card of these players in the next year's set. So you would look at these cards, and there wasn't a whole lot of information on it because this being the late 1980s, you're dealing with paper records, maybe newspaper accounts of these players' time in high school. So it wasn't really an informative card, but it was, again, in the rookie card craze of the late 80s. This was the best that Topps could do at the time. So you look at the back of Willie Ansley, and it has his complete high school batting record. Well, this is how complete it is. 85, freshman, not available. 86, sophomore, not available. 87, junior, not available. 88, senior. And then you have a little line here, his 33 games experience as a senior. And I had to share that with Sports Card Backs. I said, is this the most vague card back ever? Now, it does say, even though they don't have a whole lot of stats here, it does say that he allegedly hit a home run that measured 596 feet. Wondering if they're using different tape measures out in Texas, where he was playing. He was living in Plainview, Texas at the time. But, you know, some of our listeners doubted that, although there was a very, very funny response to our discussion about the Willie Ansley card, and that was Baseball Card Backs responding with a back of a 2007, I believe it is, yeah, 2007 Fleer card for Homer Bailey, where he didn't have any professional experience. In fact, he was just 21 years old. He was getting into the big leagues. And on the back where you normally have the stats, it said professional baseball career totals, and there was nothing. And it was just in this really tiny print, it says, no MLB experience, to which, of course, Baseball Card Backs replies, that's just lazy Fleer. So I absolutely love that. A nice little give and take with our listeners on the rather dubious card backs for Willie Ansley and Homer Bailey. By the way, Bailey at least had a little bit of a major league career. Ansley never did. He got as high as AAA in Tucson in 1993, but his career petered out in the minor leagues and the independent leagues in the mid-1990s. And, you know, some players, especially first-round draft picks, you know, some guys, they just don't make it to the major leagues for one reason or another. But I always thought that was a pretty interesting baseball card where, you know, Topps hurries up to, you know, get that first-round draft pick card. And they find the high school photograph of the guy and they, you know, scrape together some stats and some information, but they can't really deliver a whole lot because, again, pre-internet days, there's only so much information that was out there. And it left a very vague card back, to put it nicely. Wax Pack 916, inspired by your 73 Top Show, I visited my local card shop and picked up these action shot cards. I like the chin music on Willie Davis. Yes, Willie Davis, one of those cards I didn't include in my collage that I tweeted out. But yeah, Davis getting brushed back probably by Steve Carlton. He's playing the Phillies in this picture. But he includes photographs of George Scott, Chris Spire, Mark Bellinger, and Vida Blue. And, you know, the action shots for Spire and Bellinger are actually not that bad. And the George Scott one's okay, but it's one of those situations where I said, you know, the photographer was probably in the camera well behind third base. And before the days of super zoom lenses, before they came really common, it was just a very far away shot here. So Scott, who's trying to tag out a runner who's going back to first base on a pickoff play, is a little microscopic on this shot. But the Vida Blue card is the great example of the overindulgence of action shots that Topps tried to answer to in 73, as you have Blue in his windup going for a pitch, but you have a hitter, I believe that's for the Texas Rangers, who is clearly in the way of Vida Blue. So you see Blue, or the top two-thirds of him, on top of this Texas Rangers batter, and it's very, very distracting. But it's kind of funny, again, the yin and the yang of the action shots from 73 Topps. And, you know, that's something that 73 Topps is going to be remembered for, is that they just went overboard with the action shots. Some did turn out to be fairly decent, and I mentioned that in the show. There were some decent cards, but for every one decent action shot, you had two just incredibly awful, far out, wide lens shots, including the Oscar Gamble card that we featured in the podcast. So thanks again for sharing that. Also, Wax Pack 916 was the winner of our auction break. We had three packs of 82 Fleer up for grabs, and not a whole lot of action on that. And I understand why. 82 Fleer is not a very popular set. It's not one of my favorites. But I got those packs because I figured if there's one thing that redeems the 82 Fleer set, it's the Cal Ripken Jr. rookie card. And not too many people were interested. However, Wax Pack 916 did win that auction. Unfortunately, wasn't able to pull out a Ripken card in those three packs. We did get an Andre Dawson and a Paul Molitor card. So, you know, a couple cards that, you know, might get you a dollar a piece if you try to sell them. But no big hits there. So, unfortunately, Wax Pack 916, not only with the 82 Fleer packs, but a few weeks ago with the 83 Fleer packs, didn't come home with anything big. So, I'm hoping, Steve, you hang in there and take part in another auction. Hopefully, you'll end up with something big. We have had some pretty big hits in some of our auctions. We had the Mark McGwire rookie card from 85 Topps a couple weeks back. Several weeks ago, we had the Don Mattingly rookie card with 84 Topps. So, you know, it's hit and miss. It's the thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. That's what happens when you open up a wax pack, and especially these older ones from 30 plus years ago. You never know what you're going to get. You may get that big card, or you may get a whole lot of nothing. And in fact, Steve got a whole lot of checklists in that. I think you got four checklists in those three packs, three checklists in one pack. And that was one of the other complaints about not only Fleer in 1982, Donruss had this problem as well. The circulation of cards, how they were inserted into wax packs, very problematic, at least if you got the checklist. But sometimes, though, you could luck out and get maybe two Ripken cards in one pack. So you never knew what the circulation was going to bring you, but unfortunately, it didn't bring him much of way of that auction. Now, speaking of our auctions, we do have, I still have a few cello packs from 86 Fleer. Not sure what the public response to that will be, but we'll put that up eventually. Also, I am awaiting the arrival of some early 80s Donruss packs. And there was something else I got. I forgot what it was, but there's something else from the early 80s that will be coming in soon. Maybe 82 Topps. I can't even remember what I bought recently. Remember, I was on vacation. I'm kind of half brain dead right now. I'm just getting back into the swing of things. And finally, speaking of getting into the swing of things, a nice Hall of Fame induction this past weekend. Of course, a lot of people thrilled to see Tim Raines in there. And as we discussed in our 89 podcast, even though there was a lot of controversy around Raines' career, especially his cocaine addiction in the early 80s. And, you know, I posed the question, you know, was that something that helped him play better? You know, I think that was part of the controversy, not just his overall numbers being kind of on the borderline for Hall of Fame status, but, you know, all these other things that factored in. Well, he is in, and everybody was able to remember the Montreal Expos for a few more days. But Andy Viker brought up an interesting point here. He says, kind of wondering why Johnny Bench's intro at the Hall of Fame ceremony didn't include host of the Baseball Bunch. That is a good question, because if you grew up in the late 70s and early 80s, Saturday morning cartoons, this wasn't a cartoon, but this was a show that was typically inserted into the Saturday morning cartoon lineup, or sometimes late Saturday morning, kind of as a lead-in to the NBC game of the week. Baseball Bunch was an incredible show with Johnny Bench as your star host. I think Ozzie Smith was kind of the unofficial co-host. The San Diego Chicken was in every episode as well. That was quality programming. And I mentioned that it's a crime if this is not mentioned on Johnny Bench's plaque. I have yet gone to Cooperstown. It is on the bucket list. It will get done one of these days. But I was a huge fan of Johnny Bench as a kid. And I think a lot of it, granted, he was at the tail end of his career when I really first started paying any attention to baseball. And that would be early 80s, like I said, 81, 82. And a lot of it is because of the Baseball Bunch. It's partially how I knew who Johnny Bench was. But also the Cincinnati Reds had their spring training facility in Tampa, the old Al Lopez Field, which was located where Raymond James Stadium is right now. It was located next to the old Tampa Stadium. And also the Reds had their Florida State League Advance A affiliate, the Tampa Tarpons, there. So there was always this, you know, even though Tampa before the Rays was always somehow aligned with the Yankees because George Steinbrenner had a very deep connections here in Tampa Bay for many, many years. Even though there was always a connection to the Yankees, there was always a connection to the Cardinals and Mets because they did spring training over in St. Petersburg. There was always a deep line to the Cincinnati Reds because of their spring training and their Florida State League team. And I remember as a kid having, you know, those plastic replica batting helmets. I had a Cincinnati Reds batting helmet, and I pretended to be Johnny Bench. So it's funny to see somebody bring up the Baseball Bunch. And I remember, you know, like I said, even though it was at the tail end of Bench's career, the last two, three seasons of his professional career, I remember basically learning about Johnny Bench through the Baseball Bunch. And then eventually you're seeing the Cincinnati Reds on TV, or you'd see them at a spring training game. And it all started coming together. Oh yeah, that's that guy in that TV show with the big chicken and other baseball players. So thank you very much for bringing that up. That's a great memory. And just if you're too young to remember, just search YouTube for the Baseball Bunch and you will find some classic episodes, or at least portions of episodes, because I think Major League Baseball production still owns the rights to that. So they're kind of cranky when it comes to distribution of stuff. But Andy, thank you so much for sharing that. That brought up a lot of great memories. And finally, Ryan Mickelson, thank you for the kudos to us. He says, if you're a baseball card collector and aren't listening to the Wax Ecstatic podcast, give it a listen. Always appreciate the message there. And we encourage you to pass along the message to your collecting friends, either people who collect now or who collected back in the day. And, you know, maybe they don't collect as much now as they did back then. But it's always an interesting range of topics at Wax and Gum Stains, our official Twitter feed that's open 24/7. So you could talk about our podcast, the sets we talk about, the players we talk about, or the random Baseball Bunch reference that's dropped in there. Also, make sure your friends know that our new shows come out every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time as we continue to go through the big old binder of baseball cards. And we're going to be wrapping up the binder soon. The binder goes up to 1980. So be on the lookout. Next week or two, I'll be sending out another survey just asking your opinion about what you think of the show so far, what can we do better, what is something that you don't want to hear on our show anymore, but also what direction do we go in? I've got some ideas, but we'll throw them out to you. The whole reason why we went to the big old binder after the big old monster box was you told us. You know, once we got through the junk wax era cards of the 1990s, you said, let's go to the binders and start in the 50s and work our way up through 1980. So we've done that over the last few months, and we certainly appreciate your feedback. So we will be getting that in that survey, which will be sent out very shortly. Now, also, if you want to give us kudos, and I love the thanks and I love the messages that go out on Wax and Gum Stains to your collector friends, but if you feel moved, and you feel that Wax Ecstatic is a religious experience, well, just like most any other churches, we welcome all denominations, especially $10 and $20 bills. If you would like to make a cash donation, you can do so in one of two ways. We've got the PayPal account. We call it our tip jar, but the PayPal account, basically paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, that's paypal.me/waxecstatic. or we just opened a Venmo account. So if you prefer to do your cash transactions via Venmo, you can give us a donation there as well. That is venmo.com/waxecstatic. And we'll send those links out over our Twitter feed every now and then. I'm not here to beg for money. As I've mentioned many times before, we're not doing this show for money. We're doing this show because we love just looking back at these cards and these players and just talking about some great childhood memories and some great or not so great cards, as the case may be. But if you feel moved to, $5 even, something simple like that. We're not looking for $50 or $100. Well, okay, we are, but we're not expecting that from you. If you got a few bucks and you just want to make the contribution as a show of thanks, we appreciate it. And for those who have already made donations, be it just a straight up donation or through our auctions, that's how we collect for the wax pack auctions, I thank you. Appreciate all of the fine words you've said. I appreciate all the support. Even though we're not looking to make money off the show, we do have some production cost. And there's also the intangible cost. It takes a lot of time to do some research, to record this, to mix it down, to post it to our Audio Boom site. So any help that way, even if it is, like I said, just a handful of dollars, always, always, always appreciated. And again, for those who have already donated, thank you very much. I appreciate your assistance in keeping this podcast going. So we've got the new shows on Tuesdays. We've got the Flashback Friday editions. This past weekend, we took a look at the 86 Donruss set with Hubie Brooks as our random poll, speaking of Montreal Expos. The Max Headroom set of 1986. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just go back and listen to that show. You can listen to all of our shows, new and archived, via Audio Boom. Just go to audioboom.com, type in Wax Ecstatic. You'll see the whole list of shows there. Or you can listen to us via iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and TuneIn as the show is presented there. Again, new episodes every Tuesday at 10 a.m. and the archive episodes. We post links to them on Friday, but they are up at all of those platforms at any time. All right, let's take a look at 76 Tops, a set that in terms of design is a winner, in my opinion. And like I said before, you could argue this is the best set of the 1970s. Now, most people, again, will say, no, it's 71, or they'll go, no, it's 74. Some people like 70. Others may like 75 or 72, despite how loud and tacky they are. But really, 76 Tops is a set that pretty much every collector likes. There are some sets from the 70s, you either love it or you don't love it. 76 Tops, overall, across the board, most collectors really like. And for the very simple reason that it's a simple but colorful, entertaining layout. And it's also easy to collect. There were more cards produced by Tops by the mid to late 70s, not junk wax era levels where there's tens of millions of these cards still out there, but enough were produced in the general population to where if you're not buying it from a wax pack or a wax box or a factory set, you're buying loose cards or you're buying just cards in lots that are just out there now. They're still very affordable. You can get most of the cards. If it's not a star card, you can get most common cards from 76 Tops, 20, 25 cents a piece, depending on the condition. And again, the player, his star status, rookie card status, whatever, you can get them at a pretty decent price. And I say, if you can get any vintage card, by all means, go for it and don't worry about the condition. It's just great to have this piece of history in your hands. But 76 Tops is a set that, again, the design, the star power, everything that comes into it, it's a great set to collect a whole bunch of. And even if you're not looking to make a buck off of it, just to have a handful of them, just to thumb through every now and then. I've got some from a lot that I had collected. And actually, I've gotten two separate lots. I didn't have a lot of 76 Tops cards until a few years ago. But two separate lots, I've been able to collect about 200 cards. And it's a great set. Now, let's take a look at the Rick Monday card here. As one of the reasons why I like 76 Tops is the design pulls the best of the 73, 74, and 75 Tops sets. And we're going to start with 74. One of the big reasons why people love the 74 Tops set is that there's a lot of space left for the photograph. The 74 Tops set, as you heard in our podcast a few weeks ago, you have mostly picture with the little kind of flags draped around the corner at the top and the bottom, and that's pretty much it. Very simple design. Same thing here. You've got about 80% of the card is designated to the player photograph here, and the photography is actually pretty sharp in 76 Tops. Tops was starting to finally come around to getting not only better action shots, but also, as is the case here, the Rick Monday card, better pose shots here. Actually, some pretty clear photography. You didn't have the blurry action photos. You didn't have the unnecessarily up-close posed photos. This is a pretty good shot of Rick Monday here in spring training with the Cubs, probably from 1974 or 75. So you had some good photography. A lot of space was left to the photograph. So that's what comes out of 74. What comes out of 73 is the little caricature of the player's position. And that's something that I liked about 73 Tops. But with 73 Tops, the caricature was a shadow figure of that position. Well, in 76, it's an actual caricature. You know, you can actually see the, you know, the face and the, you know, details of the body and the uniform. So in the case of Rick Monday, who was an outfielder, you've got this guy just kind of chasing down a fly ball. And, you know, there was a different caricature for a catcher and for a shortstop and for a pitcher, you name it. So that's kind of a neat thing. You know, it was something different with every card. And then finally, the best thing that they pulled out of the 75 set, without being as tacky as the 75 set, the vibrant colors. And they had some pretty interesting color combinations for teams. For the example here, the Rick Monday card in the Chicago Cubs, the player's name was over a pink horizontal bar, and underneath that you had the team name, in the case of the Cubs, on a kind of a blue, I was going to say dark blue, but really more of a Cubs blue underneath the pink there. Also on that bar you had the name of the player's position on there, you know, underneath the caricature. And it all comes together really, really, really nicely. Similar to what we saw in 1960 Tops, which I said took the best of 57, 58, and 59. And while 60 Tops did a pretty good job at that, I think 76 Tops does a great job with that. So that's what makes getting a handful of these cards and looking through them, what really makes it fun with this set is you've got the different colors, you've got the different position caricatures, you've got some better photography selections that are in here. You've got the white border, but not a whole lot of space devoted to the border, you know, like the 73 set, which is one of the big complaints that collectors have is, you know, there was just too much going on with border. Not the case here in 76. You could argue this is a, you know, much better designed version of 61 Tops. 61 Tops, I've said, is kind of plain, but if you were to dress up 61 Tops with the color and with the caricature and the better pictures, then you end up with 76 Tops, basically. Now, if we flip the card over on the back, card number 251, Rick Monday, you've got his name in the banner along the top portion of the card, right beneath it, his personal information. I love the way that they put the baseball card number on here, the number being in a baseball, but right beneath the baseball, running vertically top to bottom of this card, you've got a baseball bat. So this was a nice little touch there. You've got the complete major league stats here, and depending on if space permitted, you had a neat little trivial factoid at the bottom of the card. The color combination is a pretty good one, easy to read despite the gray card back. Predominantly a light green, dare I say mint green. That's kind of the color that comes to mind. This is a rather Girl Scout cookie thin mint color collection here, where you have the mint green and along with a little bit of brown in the baseball bat, and kind of a brownish black text pretty much everywhere else. Now, green was a very dominant color on the backs of 1970s Topps cards. In fact, in the 10 sets that were released in the 1970s, green was the primary color for 5 of the card backs: 1971, 74, 76, 77, and you would see it again in 79. And green would continue on into the early 80s. You had green in 82. You had the ectoplasm cooler green in 85, and then that was pretty much it for green as a predominant color on the backs of these cards. But Topps loved them some green. I don't know if they got green ink in a pretty good bulk rate back then, but whatever the case, they love them some green, and you saw it a lot, not only in 76, but again in 77. Now, we'll talk about 77 Tops next week. There's a really neat design feature on the back of those cards, but I really think 76 Tops harkens back to 74 Tops a lot. Although with 74 Tops, it got a little cluttered with cartoons and everything. This, with the bat and just the stats and all this information, it is a very nice, clean presentation. Now, the card design overall is great. The one problem with 76 Tops, as was an issue with a lot of Tops cards in the 1970s, off-center miscut cards, and this Rick Monday card is right up there with it. If you look at it, you can see that it is not perfectly centered. It is really more 90-10 centering, with the picture being pushed down a little bit to the bottom of the card. It is not egregiously cut like some other 76 Tops cards, but that is a frequent problem. So some of the star cards or rookie cards that you're looking for, you may be able to get them at a value just because they're not perfectly centered. They may just be nudged off a little bit, like this Rick Monday card. But again, if you don't really care too much about the condition, you too can have a 76 Tops Mike Schmidt card or Pete Rose card or Nolan Ryan card. And because it's off-center, you're able to buy it for just $5 as opposed to $15, $20, $25, whatever the seller is looking for in what would be a gem mint card, or at least close to a gem mint card. But the 76 top set, even though it is a beautiful design, it does get overlooked because it does not have that really knockout collection of rookie cards like 75 Tops did. Because of the Robin Yount and Gary Carter and the George Brett rookie cards in 75, people overlooked the tacky design because those are huge rookie cards. Well, in 76 Tops, it was kind of the exact opposite. You had a great design, not as big of a rookie class, but some notable names that we need to pass along here. The biggest rookie card, arguably the Dennis Eckersley card. I'm sure David Price has a few of those in his collection. We also have Willie Randolph, Ron Guidry, and a couple other notable rookies, Mike Flanagan, Larry Parrish. Bigger cards, though, other than like the Parrish and Flanagan rookie cards and even the Guidry card, is the second-year card for Gary Carter and George Brett and Robin Yount. So you can find those in a lot of collectors' hands because, again, it's you're not going to spend a fortune on the 76 Tops George Brett as you would on the 75 Tops. Still, 76 Tops will cost you a pretty penny if that's what you're looking for. You also had the unique subsets. A lot of fans on our Twitter feed were talking about the MVP set in 75. You had some pretty unique sets. You had the record breakers for cards 1 through 6. And of course, because a lot of kids handled baseball cards differently back then, namely with rubber bands, cards 1 through 6 are very hard to find in gem mint condition. You had the father and son cards, which were pretty neat. League leaders, also postseason highlights. In fact, I've got one of those. I've got the 75 World Series, which, of course, is one of the best World Series in baseball history. And that's a neat card there. You also have the All-Stars, which are presented by the Sporting News. And in fact, they are all-time All-Stars. And then, of course, you've got the rookie multi-picture cards where you had, and you saw this in a lot of sets in the 70s with Tops, where you had four rookies featured on one card and they were grouped together by position, not necessarily teams. So a whole lot to find in 76 Tops and a whole lot of cards still out there. Again, not junk wax era levels, but enough to where the average man can go out there and buy a lot of these cards. And again, you can find some star cards for some pretty decent prices. You know, like I said, you can get Nolan Ryan, you can get Mike Schmidt, you can get Pete Rose, you can find these cards, Reggie Jackson. You know, a lot of these cards for under $20, and that is not a bad deal considering, you know, these are star players from that era at the, you know, the pinnacle of their career or just about to enter the pinnacle of their career. So some great cards and some great players that are still out there. And this is absolutely, if not because of the star power, just because of the, you know, the fact that this is a vintage card set that most anybody can get their hands on. And the design is great. This is a set that if you can find, you know, a lot of these or, you know, maybe a hand-collated set for a decent price, I say absolutely go after it. It's a fun set to collect. Now, our random pull, as I mentioned, it's rather appropriate that Rick Monday is our pull for 76 Tops because he is best remembered for three events in his career, and one happened in 1976. Let's talk a little bit about that. Monday, who was an outfielder for the Chicago Cubs, April 25th, 1976, a game at Dodger Stadium. Monday is out in the outfield, and in between a play, a couple of fans, a father and son, believe it or not, like a teenage boy and his father, go running out to the outfield. They've got an American flag. They lay the flag down. They have a bottle of lighter fluid. They just douse the thing with lighter fluid, and they're going to light the flag on fire. Now, I've seen video of this. I don't know where the Dodger Stadium security team was at the time. I know it was different in the 70s compared to now. You can thank 9/11 for that. But, you know, first of all, how you smuggle in a bottle of lighter fluid is beyond me. But you know, these guys, they could have, you know, set up a tent out there. The security team was so lax in getting out there and taking care of the situation. So seeing what was going on, players and coaches started, you know, running out to the outfield. Tommy Lasorda was the third base coach for the Dodgers then. Walt Alston was in his final year as manager. Lasorda's running out to the outfield. He had a couple of other Cubs players who see what's happening. They start making their way out there. Well, Rick Monday comes in, and he just swoops down and grabs the flag and runs off with it. And then the security finally, you know, gets this father-son duo and haul him off the premises. Now, in recounting this incident, Monday said, fortunately, it was a very windy day, so the guys couldn't light the flag, despite the fact they doused it in lighter fluid. And he also remembered thinking as he's running in, he's like, well, I could have just bowled right over them, which certainly would have changed, I think, the outcome and how people remembered it as, you know, outfielder attacks fans on the field. But instead, because he came in and he swooped down and he picked up the flag, it's one of the most patriotic moments in baseball history. And it's not one of those phony baloney patriotic moments, i.e. Sammy Sosa, 2001, after the 9/11 attacks, hitting a home run and running around Wrigley Field with a flag in his hand. That was just one of the biggest BS baloney. Yay, we're patriotic here. Let's, you know, that was so prefabricated. It was just stupid. This was, as we say in the marketing world, organic. You know, it happened. Monday comes in, swoops down, picks up the flag, and the Dodger Stadium crowd is elated. There was, you know, the Dodgers even acknowledged it on the scoreboard. They said, Rick Monday, you made a great play. Monday even remembered, you know, once things settled down, all of a sudden, you know, just impromptu, the crowd starts singing God Bless America. So it was a really overwhelming patriotic moment. And you have to think back to when this happened. First of all, 1976, it was the summer of the bicentennial. You know, it was a very patriotic year, and people were caught up in the patriotic, you know, swooning that was going on because America was turning 200 years old. But also, you were still living the fallout from Watergate, which, you know, came to a crashing finish about 18, 19 months before. There was, you know, the economic problems going on at the time, international problems. You know, America was going through, as Jimmy Carter would later say, a crisis of confidence. So, you know, in fact, there was such a patriotic swell. That's how Jimmy Carter got elected as president that year. But you also had, and I think why a lot of people, even in the quote unquote left leaning Los Angeles community, you know, a lot of people by 1976 were just done with Vietnam era protests and, you know, Vietnam era, you know, summers of love. They were just done with it. And of course, the Vietnam War officially ended the previous summer, 1975, with the fall of Saigon. And, you know, a lot of people were wondering, wait a minute, you know, we were involved in Vietnam for 20 years, and what did we get out of it? Nothing but a bunch of, you know, dead people and maimed soldiers coming back. So there was just this big, big swell of patriotism going on in 1976. So that played into the whole thing that's going on here. And even Monday has said, one reason why he just automatically, you know, as he's seeing what's going on, he automatically just ran out there and picked up the flag. He had seen, you know, growing up in the mid-60s, being blessed to play baseball and not get drafted into Vietnam. And by the way, he served in the Marine ROTC when he was at Arizona State in the early 60s. you know, he knew people that came back from Vietnam completely changed, if not physically, then mentally and emotionally. And he's said time and time again, you know, I can't see why anybody else wouldn't have done this. So it's something that he's best remembered for of the three events. It's the one thing he's best remembered for. And even Monday has said, if I'm only remembered for this particular act, that's not a bad thing. And it certainly isn't, regardless of whatever your political beliefs are, to see somebody come in and, you know, make this, you know, saving of the burning of the flag here. And again, even if you agree with First Amendment rights that say you can do that, you know, just the timing, again, you know, with Vietnam ending and Watergate ending and the crisis of confidence and just all this other nonsense that America was kind of feeling in 1976, which was a complete 180 from the patriotism that you're supposed to be feeling because it's the bicentennial year. It was right place, right time for something like this to happen and for Rick Monday to come to the rescue. And there's a very famous picture of, you know, Monday, you know, grabbing the flag off the ground and the two protesters, you know, sitting on the grass going like, hey, that's our flag. So it's probably the best known moment in Rick Monday's career. The other two moments, one from 1965, and it's actually mentioned on the back of this card. You can wow your friends with this trivial tidbit. Rick Monday was the first player selected in the first amateur Major League Baseball draft, number one overall by the Kansas City Athletics in 1965. The irony is the Dodgers tried to sign him in 1963. He offered his family, or the team offered his family a lot of money. However, the Arizona State Sun Devils were able to coax him over to school. Monday was a teammate of Reggie Jackson's at the time, and he was an absolute star at Arizona State as well. And because he spurned the Dodgers in 1963, by the time he became draft eligible in 1965, the A's were able to sweep him up with the first overall selection in draft history. Now, he starts his career in Kansas City in 1966, moves with the A's to Oakland in 1968, earns an All-Star acknowledgement in his first full season in Oakland in 1968, a year in which he hit .274. Only had 8 home runs, but 132 hits. Pretty dependable glove in the outfield as well. And he started a pretty, you know, I wouldn't say superstar, but a pretty consistent career in Oakland. You know, a guy that you can count on to be good in the outfield, a guy who, you know, would hit probably, I'd say, you know, 265, 270, maybe 280 on average during this time. And a guy who was pretty healthy, like I said, pretty dependable, and a good glove out there as well. He was never a Gold Glove winner, but he was a guy that you could pencil into the lineup and you knew what you were going to get out of Rick Monday. Now, after the 1971 season, the A's decide to trade Monday, picking up a piece who was key in the A's success in the mid-1970s, trading him to Chicago for pitcher Kenny Holtzman. And while the A's were able to succeed with Holtzman in the lineup, the Cubs were also able to boast about having a star of their own in Monday. Now, it didn't look that way in his first season in Chicago in 1972, pretty pedestrian season of a .249 batting average and 11 home runs, but he really hit his stride really at the peak of his career in his late 20s as his batting average went up again around the .280 range. But he also started getting a little more power in his stroke as he was starting to average, I'd say, about 24 home runs during this time. Now, in 1976, he was not an All-Star, but he was in the MVP voting race for the National League, a distant 18th place vote in the final voting tally, as he hit .272 that year, but his career best 32 home runs as a member of the Cubs, and of course, best remembered for his patriotic duty earlier on that season. Now, just before the 1977 season started, the Cubs traded him along with Mike Garman to the Dodgers for Bill Buckner, Ivan DeJesus, and Jeff Albert, who never made it to the pros. Of course, we all know what happened with Bill Buckner. Buckner would have a pretty good career with Chicago before his rather ignominious time with Boston later on in the 80s. And Ivan DeJesus, of course, involved in a trade with Philadelphia, which netted the Cubs one guy named Ryan Sandberg. Well, Monday goes to L.A. and continues his pretty consistent play appearing in just 118 games in 1977 and 119 games in 1978. But he did make an All-Star appearance in 1978 and was part of the two National League pennant winners. The Dodgers, unfortunately, running up against the buzzsaw that was the Bronx Zoo, New York Yankees, in 77 and 78. As the 70s became the 80s, Monday was starting to wear down, had to deal with a lot of injury issues. Also, though, had to deal with just better talent that was popping up through the Dodger farm system and displacing him in the outfield. Of course, the National League doesn't have the designated hitter rule, so he was platooned when he was healthy. He was a member of the World Champion Dodgers in 1981, and that was the year where he performed the third thing that he is best remembered for. And outside of Bud Selig, Rick Monday is quite possibly the most hated baseball person in Montreal, as it was Rick Monday off of a not-so-well-rested Steve Rogers Game 5 1981 National League Championship Series. Monday took Rogers, I won't even say yard, damn near took him out of the yard, Olympic Stadium. This is before they had the roof in there. He hit a ball that actually hit the facade to the ring, to the roof. And that ended the Expos' best chance at getting to the World Series. Now, I know there's still the argument that in 1994, the Expos, who had their best record through that number of games, had the baseball strike not happened, the Expos probably could have won a World Series. Well, still remember, in 1994, you had the wild card, you know, the division series that you had to play through, then the championship series, and then the World Series. 1994 was the first season where you had three divisions within each league. You had that extra round of playoffs. So even though people still lament the 1994 strike killing what could have been with the Montreal Expos, it is not guaranteed, and I can't stress this enough, it is not guaranteed that the Expos would have won the World Series in 1994. It might have been their best chance, but there's no guarantee they would have won it. And I've mentioned this before, a lot of people forget in 1994, you know, the Indians had this phenomenal season. You know, they would eventually build up to a pretty strong team in the late 90s. The Yankees were coming back to you know, a position where they could play for a playoff spot. They would have ended a 13-year drought had they been able to play through the season too. So it's not automatic that the Expos would have won. But outside of 1994, and as I mentioned, Bud Selig and Donald Fehr, Expos fans are not thrilled about Rick Monday, as he is the guy who hit what turned out to be the series clinching home run. And that day is still, what is it now, 36 years later, is still referred to as Blue Monday. And as I mentioned, the Dodgers would go on to actually beat the Yankees this time around in the World Series. And that was it for the World Series experience of Rick Monday. He would continue with the Dodgers through the 1984 season, and then he would call it a career at the age of 38. As I mentioned, injuries and the platooning system really wore down his numbers in the final, I'd say, 5-6 years of his career. But still, 19 years in the big leagues, 1,986 games. He compiled 1,619 hits, 241 home runs, and pretty consistent across the board. A guy, if you look at baseballreference.com, you look at the 162 game average, which is a little bit of a misnomer because he never played 162 games. His career high was 149 in 1973 with the Cubs. But if he were to play 162 games, his average would read 264 average, 20 home runs, 20 doubles, 63 RBIs. So a pretty consistent guy, not just at the plate, but also in the outfield. Now, he's not just best known for being the first ever draft pick and for saving the American flag and for ruining Expos fans' expectations in 1981, but he has become a broadcaster and has done some occasional broadcast stints with the San Diego Padres, but also mostly with the LA Dodgers. He's done some national games as well. So he's been able to keep his career going and his name out there for almost 30 years now. He's been doing a lot of work, again, not just doing play-by-play, but also doing some pregame and postgame stuff as well. And oh, by the way, the Expos fans have not forgotten about Rick Monday. In fact, a very humorous story that is passed along. If you look up his Wikipedia entry, he was held up at Dorval Airport by a Canadian immigration officer. He missed his connecting flight. And when Monday asked, why he was being held up and how he could miss his flight, the officer said, are you that guy who used to play for the Dodgers, the Rick Monday? Oh, well, what do you know? Wait over there, please. And I can tell you through my own personal experience, that's happened to me in 2009. The NHL entry draft was in Montreal. And that was the same summer where there were all sorts of trade rumors that the Tampa Bay Lightning were going to trade Vinny LeCavalier, Montreal native, to the Canadiens. And, there's all sorts of shoulda, woulda, couldas with that deal. Was there a deal in place? Who was involved? But it was still pretty hot in June of 2009. People thought that by July 1st, Vinny LeCavalier might be traded to the Canadiens. And I had this big piece of broadcasting equipment. It's a Comrex ISDN unit. And it's a big box that was carried around in a big suitcase. I had to lug that damn thing around Montreal for 3 or 4 days. Well, I'm carrying the suitcase into the airport as I'm getting ready to get on my flight home. And yes, it was a connecting flight. It connected through Atlanta. So there was no way that I could miss this flight or else, I might be spending hours, if not a day, in the Montreal airport trying to get back home to Tampa. And the customs guy gave me such a hard time. What is this? What does it do? Why are you carrying this? Did you fill out this form? And I'm starting to sweat here. It's just like, come on, hey, I need to catch my flight. I don't want to miss my connecting flight. So he puts me through the ringer and is, I'm going to let you go this time, but you need to make sure you have this form filled out and you have to have, this unplugged and this, that, the other. So zips up the suitcase. Okay, yes, thank you, officer. I appreciate it. And he looks at me. I can laugh about it now, but I wanted to just stab the guy back then, which really would have looked bad on my record stabbing a federal employee. But the guy looks at me and goes, one other thing. I said, yes. He says, are the Lightning going to trade LeCavalier to the Canadian? I'm like, screw you. I'm getting out of here. So it's not just Rick Monday. It can happen to anybody who crosses paths with a Montreal sports fan, especially the Canadiens. But longtime Expos fans, they do not forget that type of stuff. And we don't forget Rick Monday, who had a very consistent career on the field, remembered for a handful of things throughout his career, but also a very involved broadcaster for well over 30 years now with the Padres and with the Dodgers. So there you go. A look at Rick Monday, 76 tops, a very popular set. A lot of fans love this set. And despite the off-centering and off-cut problems that you see, chronic throughout the 70s top sets, still a very popular set. And some great cards with it, too. Great photography, great design. And again, I'm not going to tell you that you're going to make a lot of money buying some of these cards and selling them back, but I would just strongly suggest if you've got 20 or 30 bucks handy, go to your local card shop or go on eBay or Amazon, wherever you buy your cards online. See if you can find a lot of cards. Don't worry about the condition. Chances are, because it's 76, they're not as beat up as a lot of cards from the 50s and 60s. You're probably finding some in very good condition and maybe even better. But those are the cards that don't make a lot of money for card salespeople. Certainly an Eckersley rookie will, or the Brett or the Yount second year cards will. But, these are cards that they're willing to part with at a decent price. For $20 or $30, you could probably end up with, 100 or so cards from 76 tops. If you have that opportunity, take it. It's a fun set to look at, front and back. A really good thing for collectors to hang on to all these years later. All right, we are going to make our way to 1977. One of my favorite sets, even though it doesn't quite match up to 76 tops. I love 77 tops for a number of reasons. One, 1977 was my birth year, so I always have that connection with the set. Two, as a Toronto Blue Jays fan in my youth, that was the year the Blue Jays were born as well, so I've always had that connection too. Three, that really unique feature on the back of the cards. I know some collectors don't care for it, but I'll talk about it a little bit in the next show. And it's really just a nice, fun set. Again, it doesn't quite have the wow factor of 76, but it's still up there. It's one of the last really nice cards that Topps produced before they kind of sat back on their heels for a few years before the competition of Donruss and Fleer came around in 1981. So we'll take a look at 77 Tops in our next new podcast that will be next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. In the meantime, follow us on Wax and Gum Stains for our Flashback Friday episode this weekend. Also, information on our next auction break, and we will be sending out details on that next survey as well. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks, as always, for tuning into Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next week.